Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
My wife and I would never want to go back to the kind of prayer life and spiritual life we had before the cancer. Never. The way you look at your time, the way you look at God, the way you look at your spouse, the way you look at everything just changes when you actually realize time is limited and I'm mortal. In our culture, the mindset is that forgiveness is the opposite of justice, and since everybody's, especially younger people, are very concerned, rightly, about justice, forgiveness doesn't seem to fit with that.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, a very happy new year to you, and a real treat to start us off on the show in 2023, the recording of our live show with Tim Keller. Welcome along. A lot of people have been looking forward to this one, for which I was joined by my wonderful colleague, Ruth Jackson, and hundreds of Unbelievable listeners. I hope you had a good Christmas and New Year. And I should say to our friends on the east coast of the US who've been buffered by that blizzard over the holidays, my opening conversation with Tim about the weather in New York versus the UK will seem rather anachronistic, but I hope you got through it wherever you were. Thanks as well to all of those who responded to our end of year appeal as well. It does make a huge difference to us starting 2023 strong. And do listen out later on in the show for another opportunity to give that's connected with our conversation with Tim Keller today. Just a heads up as well that our next live show is only just around the corner. On Tuesday, the 10th of January, I'll be joined by Dr. John Wyatt. Artificial intelligence, advanced robotics, DNA technology. We'll be talking about the sci-fi world of today. How do we live faithfully in a technologically confusing world? Well, John is host of our Matters of Life and Death podcast, author of The Robot Will See You Now. He's very much a biotech ethicist by background, and he'll be joining me to take your questions on our first live show of the new year. That's this coming Tuesday, the 10th of January. As ever, free to attend online. You just need to register at unbelievable.live. That link is also with today's show and includes links to our website where you can find all our latest podcasts, articles, and resources. But right now, here's our evening with Tim Keller. Welcome along. This is Unbelievable Live with me, Justin Brierley. And we're really pleased to be joined tonight by Tim Keller. Just before I introduce Tim, though, I'm also joined tonight on the show by my colleague, Ruth Jackson, who presents some of the podcasts from Premier Unbelievable and is head of Youth Apologetics. Hello, Ruth.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. And very much looking forward to our guest who has just popped up on the screen as well, Tim Keller. Tim, welcome along.
Glad to be here, Justin. Finally.
Absolutely, yeah. It's been a little while in the making, this conversation, so I'm really glad you could join us. Just let me just sing your praises a little bit and embarrass you, Tim. Tim is a renowned pastor, thinker, author, well known for his many books, encouraging thinking, faith, making the intellectual case for Christianity. He has a new book out, actually, Forgive, Why Should I and How Can I? And in fact, we've got a link to this in the chat if you want to get hold of it. It's Tim's latest book. Available everywhere good books are sold. So do go and check that out as well. And we'll talk a little bit about that today. But before we get into some of the serious questions, how's the weather in New York for you, Tim, at the moment?
It's great. It's actually cold, in the 30s Fahrenheit, but at the same time, it's clear. So it's actually quite a lovely day today.
We've been having snow here in the UK. So it's very cold for us. But that's not uncommon in New York, is it, at this time of year?
No, usually I would say we would get a lot more snow than London would, but sorry.
There we go. There's nothing more British than talking about the weather.
I was just about to say, I wanted to commend you on your Britishness there.
I mean, you've had a bit of a love affair with the Brits. You frequently have come over in your time here, Tim. What's the connection there? Why, as a primarily a US-based pastor and speaker and thinker and author, have you connected so much, do you think, with the UK?
Yes, my guess, my wife and I, we believe that probably up until the pandemic happened, there was probably almost a 30-year period in which we came almost at least a couple times a year. Hmm. And the reasons were very diverse. In the very beginning, it was actually my Presbyterian roots. And I would come and largely talk to Presbyterian groups. But then what happened was, which, you know, took me to Scotland more to the, but eventually it accumulates, you know, somebody hears you and says, oh, I want you to come back and talk to my group. And it just got accumulated. Also, we just also developed not just ministry colleagues, but real friendships. I don't know if they're on, but for example, Ray and Jill Lane in Ambleside, which isn't a bad place to have friends. I just want you to know Ambleside, the Lake District. And so we started to take holidays there too. So that's why.
Oh, that's really nice. Well, look, we've got people joining us from all over the world, not just the US and UK. Ruth, do you want to read out where some of these folks are joining us from?
Yeah. So we've got a couple of people from Sydney, Brooklyn, Sweden, Ontario in Canada, Ontario.
That's
definitely
right.
Not saying that right. New Jersey.
Ontario. Come on. Use your nose.
Ontario.
You don't use your nose when you talk.
We've got, Tokyo, Japan, Norway, Manila in the Philippines, Berlin, Germany, London, Scotland, Netherlands. I mean, it feels like everywhere.
It's a very international gathering.
Jamaica, I've just spotted.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, feel free to continue adding where you're watching or listening from in the chat. It's wonderful to have lots of people joining us for tonight's discussion with Tim. Tim, we've titled this Walking with God Through Cancer, and because obviously that has dominated obviously your story over the last couple of years. Tell us just firstly, what is the latest with your health and treatment and so on?
Well, they put it in a capsule form. I was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer in May of 2020. That, as you all know, that's a very, very deadly kind of cancer. And yet I'm about to celebrate my third Christmas with my family. So the reasons for that is I had 2 years of chemotherapy here in New York City, and it kind of kept the cancer at bay somewhat. And now I'm in an immunotherapy drug trial at the National Institute for Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And that is actually working too. So my cancer is still there. Pancreatic cancer can break out anytime and take you. And yet it we've been able to keep it somewhat at bay for a pretty long time. And so we're very grateful.
I mean, Tim, this might be really hard for you to define, or it might be something that you've thought about a lot, but what would you say are some of the kind of highs and lows over this past 2 years, this journey that you've been struggling with?
Oh, Ruth, it wouldn't be surprised to anyone else with cancer or anyone who has friends or loved ones with cancer that you have to constantly have scans. In other words, you get scans and tests, and they happen. It depends. They can happen every month, every 2 months, every 3 months. And I have to say that coming right up to those scans, we have a word called scansiety. Mm-hmm. Because you know that it doesn't matter how good the last one was, this one could show that it's out of control.
Yeah.
Every single time. And so the low lights are every time you're going in and you're waiting for the test results. And so, I mean, that's obviously one. And the other is that every little ache and pain that you for most of your life, you say, well, that's probably nothing. And now you say, is that the cancer? The highlights, and this is going to sound like an exaggeration. My wife and I would never want to go back to the kind of prayer life and spiritual life we had before the cancer. Never.
Wow.
It's I spent all my life saying that communion with God, the real presence of God, You know, satisfy us this morning, every morning, with your steadfast love, which is definitely a request for experience. So what does it mean, satisfy us every morning with our with your steadfast love? That can't mean remind me. It means satisfy me with your love. And I spent all of my career telling people it was available and experiencing some of it. But actually, every so often, Kathy and I will say, we're having a much better life now.
Wow. Wow. That's quite remarkable. Just sticking with the journey you've been on, though, in the last couple of years there, Tim, I remember, I think it possibly the last time I connected with you on the show was to talk about your book, Walking with God Through Suffering. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was written in a different time of your life. Is there anything you would revisit now, you know, having spelled out the theory, now that you've kind of lived the practice of it? What was there anything you'd write differently or think differently now?
No. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll tell you, I hope that doesn't sound arrogant. The fact was that I wrote that, let's see, I guess I was already 60-something, and I'd already been in ministry for 35 years, and therefore I walked with an awful lot of suffering people who suffered worse than I did. And so I learned that from the Bible and pastoral experience, not from personal experience. But it turns out, I guess, that most of the people I walked with, the things that helped them, the things that comforted them, the things that you might say worked for them. I mean, obviously, work doesn't mean get rid of the pain or the suffering. It means that you can endure it and even grow in it. And those things actually have worked for me, using the term work that way.
Mm. I mean, Tim, do you think there's anything that you would say that you've learned in this time that you perhaps didn't know before? I mean, you mentioned walking alongside people, and obviously you would have experienced suffering, but I guess nothing to this extent from a personal perspective.
Well, yes, I already mentioned the fact that it's almost like when it comes to prayer, I really thought that I, you know, had a good prayer life. And when I broke through into another dimension, I realized, my goodness, I was much, much, much less. Frankly, my prayer life wasn't very good. But the other thing I would say is everyone knows they're going to die. And yet everyone knows that they really, in some ways, repress that and live as if they're never going to die. We all know that. We all say that. But it's not till you have not just cancer. I had thyroid cancer when I was a 52, but the first thing the doctor said is, this is very treatable. Pancreatic cancer, the first time I talked to a doctor, my doctor says, you're going to die of this. It's sooner or later, because we don't have a cure for it. And I realized I never really did believe I was going to die. At some deep level, I just didn't. And I don't think there's, looking back on it, I don't think there's any way to go through the change that happens in you when you know you really are going to die. The way you look at your time, the way you look at God, the way you look at your spouse, the way you look at everything just changes when you actually realize time is limited and I'm mortal. Mm. And I would have lived a better life if, frankly, in my 40s, I'd been able to do it.
Yeah.
There is some kind of denial that's there that just will not go away until you actually have a doctor saying, you're going to die of this, and you could die of this within weeks. It all depends.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I mean, obviously this whole period has forced you as a very active person in ministry and so on to step back, to put a lot of things on hold. How have you coped with, as it were, being less active in a kind of forced way because of this?
Justin, it's been great. The thing I saw was that I actually was too active.
Right.
And I'd been too active for too long. And even though I am still less active than if I didn't have the cancer, I'd probably be a little more active than now. But it's actually, I'm closer to where I should have been most of my life. I am very blessed in that God did not make my relationships with my sons are good. My sons are believers. I'm got a great relationship with my wife, and that is nothing but God's grace, because I was too active. And everybody, I felt like everybody said, you have to do this for me. And okay, I have to do this for you. And no, the answer is it's been great to be it's been good for everybody around me and me.
Tim, your latest book, as Justin mentioned, is called Forgive. Why
I'm holding it up now.
There we go. Get a look at that. Why this topic of forgiveness and why now in the midst of everything you're going through?
By the way, Ruth, I could have dedicated it to Justin because the number of times he's asked me to be on this program and I said no. He's clearly a very forgiving person. So he could have been dedicated to him. He came in third though, so I...
Endless patience with you, Tim. Endless patience. No, seriously.
Well, I did sense that we have a more that we're losing in the West. We're losing our grip on the value of forgiveness. We have more and more people not only showing that they will not forgive, they don't forgive. They're pretty harsh and combative in their general demeanor and the way in which they talk to people. But some just speak right out and say forgiveness is not a good idea. And what I try to say in the book is there's partly that I understand that, because forgiveness in many cases has been abused, as when you say to a woman in a church who's been sexually abused, and you come to her and you say, well, you know, you have to forgive your perpetrator. He repented. So you need to meet together, and he repented. You have to forgive, and you can't go to the police. You can't, you know. So that's an abuse. that's an abuse.
Yeah.
But because the reality is that forgiving is not opposed to seeking justice. As a matter of fact, if you don't forgive, you won't seek justice. You'll seek vengeance, which always is going past what justice demands, and it always eats you up. So I would say you do need to forgive and pursue justice. It's not either or. But right now in our culture, the mindset is that forgiveness is the opposite of justice. And since everybody's, especially younger people, are very concerned rightly about justice, forgiveness doesn't seem to fit with that. Yeah. So I thought I'd write a book that just lifted up the biblical material, but tried to apply it to our cultural moment.
When it comes to our cultural moment, it feels like, I know exactly what you mean when you say we're living in a sort of more graceless kind of culture. How do we, I don't know, swim against that tide? Because we're all to some extent, I think, being swept up in these culture wars where it's a very combative, divisive, you know, kind of game. What do you think? What can Christians do to sort of be, I guess, Jesus in the culture we're living in?
I'm not really going to be able to give you some real great answer, Justin, that everybody's going to say, wow, Tim really. No, I think the answer is we have to do it with great difficulty and tenacity, which is to speak the truth in love. If you're not clear about what Christians believe, then there's no possibility of persuasion. But if you're not loving in the way in which you speak, there is also no possibility of persuasion. And Paul says, we persuade. And the idea is not to either cozy up to people, you know, and just get them to like you if they have a different opinion, but at the same time, not to pour out on them and just and bash them. So I think it's very difficult because right now that's just not what's out there. And so I don't have a secret. Mm-hmm. There's no secret sauce.
I mean, interestingly, though, your name came up probably 6 months or more ago in regard to this sort of whole question of how should Christians conduct themselves in the midst of these questions, because there was an article written which questioned whether we need to move on, essentially, from the from the winsome style of Tim Keller that maybe was suitable for a kind of what it called neutral culture, where Christianity, right, while not being reviled, was not particularly praised. It was somewhere in the middle. Now it says, hey, we've moved on to a culture where Christianity is seen in negative terms, and it's almost a bit like you've got to fight fire with fire. You know, you've got to go in with a more kind of combative, assertive. You can't just say, hey, let's all try and be friends and speak in a winsome manner. So you got, I guess, you know, your whole sort of way of doing things was being questioned and challenged in that kind of conversation that was going on in social media at the time. I'm sure you got wind of that, Tim.
Yes.
What's your feeling on that whole sort of, you know, debate that sparked?
I'll say two things pretty brief.
Yeah.
Because I still think this is a little more of a US issue than a UK issue. And in the United States, up until fairly recently, if you lived in big parts of this country, especially in the Southeast or the Midwest, or even lots of the West, at least away from the coasts, Christianity was seen either as a positive or as a neutral way. It was either regarded as positively or neutrally. Okay. That was not the case in the Northeast. In New York City, when I got here in 1989, no. It was much more like it has been in the UK for a very long time, or Europe, which is Christianity is seen as sort of at least just, you know, we tried that. It didn't really work. I mean, that's the European approach. We've tried that. It doesn't really work. And it is negative. I mean, it, not necessarily always hostile, because British people tend to be just a little more courteous than America, but it's certainly disdainful. And an awful lot of Christians in America just did not experience that until fairly recently. And so they say, well, the Tim Keller Winsome approach doesn't work. Well, listen, the Tim Keller approach was forged in New York City. And I'm sorry, it was never a neutral or positive world. So whatever you say about my approach, I was forged in a negative world. The second thing, though, is, and this is really where it becomes more US than UK, and this is the people who are saying it's time not to be so winsome. These are folks who actually want to change the political world here. They would like the state to be more overtly Christian. They want Christians to be much more politically active in bringing that about. I think that's a little bit hard for most of us, say my British Christian friends, to even understand. And what they therefore don't want, and you can't be winsome there. You basically have to get political.
Yeah.
And a lot of folks feel like my approach has always been to say, and I will say it right now, is whatever our political future is, and there is a problem. In fact, it is also true in Europe, too, that there's the rise of the right. There's the left. There's no doubt there's instability. And I don't know the way forward. But I think that there's room for differences of opinion amongst Christians who are united on the gospel. But they would rather me not say that over here. They would rather say, no, the Christian church has to be aligned with a particular political agenda. And that's really their motive, I think. And I think it's a little hard. Frankly, I do find it hard because we're very much in touch with people in Africa and Christians in Africa, China, Europe. And they're trying to say, what's going on there?
Yeah.
What in the world? Yeah. And I said, well, you have to understand right now there's a movement among some Christians who say we have to be more politically aligned.
There's some interesting comments in the comment section as well, sort of, you know, saying what it's like in their context. And do please keep those comments coming, and do also keep your questions coming, because we're going to be throwing to your questions very soon. But before we do that, Tim, over the past year, you've published a series of sort of lengthy essays on Gospel in Life, on the decline and renewal of the American church, and sort of presenting its challenges and opportunities. Obviously, you're speaking within a US context, but I'm well aware that you have a pretty good handle on the global church. So what are some of your main fears for the church right now? And I guess on the flip side, what gives you hope for the future of the church in the West?
Well, I'll give you three of each.
Excellent.
Okay? It's not just
one. A true preacher.
A true preacher, yeah, except that they don't all start with the letter P, because I'm not Welsh, I'm American. Well, the three fears are when people lose their hope that the church can actually thrive in our modern culture. When they lose hope, there's three things they can go into. One is you compromise on doctrine. You compromise on historic faith and practice. You say, we're just going to have to change that because we'll never get accepted. So you compromise. The second possibility is you withdraw into high walls around the church, and you basically are just going to keep hold of your kids and grow the church biologically, like the Amish. Okay. And the third is you get very combative and you say, we're going to try to take over the culture and let Christians run things. And I do fear that all three of those are certainly possibilities in the United States. And my guess is different parts of the world would be different. The three hopes are the growth of the global church. There's no doubt about it that overall Christianity is growing. And by the way, It tends to be shrinking in places where the, as you know, the birth rate is also shrinking. And what that does mean is overall, you looking forward, Christianity is not going away in any way at all. It's growing and it will continue to grow. The second hope I have is that Jesus actually said the gates of hell are not going to prevail against my church. You know, and there's no, like I like to say, there's no expiration date on that offer. And then lastly, I actually think secularism looks exhausted, but I'm not going to, that's my, I don't, it doesn't look to me like it's really confidently saying we really have all the answers to all the basic human problems. So you put all that together, I got a lot of hope, but I still have a lot of fear.
Yeah. The church is not perfect, but it's often a lot better than secular humanism in terms of the answers. Well, look, so much I wish we could continue talking about. Well, we must go to some questions from our audience tonight. Just to say, and Ruth, you'll take the first question, but before we go to those, we want to let you know that we've got a couple of really great things that we want to tell you about. Firstly, if you haven't heard already, John Lennox has worked with us on a new online course on science, faith, and the evidence for God. It's a really great way of just working at your own pace through some great conversations and lectures from John on these issues. Secondly, if you like what we do here at Premier Unbelievable and you want to support us, we would love you to do that if you feel able. In fact, if you're able to support us financially to continue producing shows like this, all of our video podcast article resources and so on, then we'll even send you a free ebook. And it's actually in conversation with Tim Keller. This is based on some conversations I've had with Tim over the years. And it very much covers some of the stuff we're talking about tonight: suffering, theology, God, ministry. So we'll send you that as a thank you for your gift, if you're able to give. There are links to that as well coming in the chat. So thank you so much if you're able to do
that.
And
you know, Justin, I just love John Lennox. John Lennox's smile.
Who doesn't love
the
John
smile?
Lennox?
When you see him smile, you feel like, you know, things are going to be all right. all by itself, it's a spiritual experience. So yeah. Definitely don't miss it.
Absolutely. You're listening to Unbelievable, and we'll hear what questions came in for Tim in the next part of today's show. Just a heads up as well that it's not too late to get that ebook I just mentioned, In Conversation with Tim Keller, as a thank you for a gift. We've actually got the donation link still open for podcast listeners. That's at premierunbelievable.com/Keller, or simply find it with the info with today's show. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, welcome back to the show. We're hearing the audio of our recent live edition of the program with Tim Keller, talking about his journey with cancer, his prayer life, forgiveness, and more. So let's pick it up as Ruth Jackson leads off with some of the questions that came in from our live audience.
There's so many brilliant questions and really honest, heartfelt questions. So thank you so much for sharing so honestly. This is from Joseph, and he says, I'm a primary caregiver for my mother who has stage 4 skin cancer, and she's definitely had those lows that you spoke of. When she has those lows, what do you think is the most helpful thing for me to do to push her closer to Jesus, as we both know that the end is very likely near?
Well, here's what I'd like to do, and it's almost a trick. And that is to say, I want to pray for you. Now, you say mom, dad, whoever. You say, I'd like to pray for you, but tell me, I want to go to God right now and pray for you. But is there anything in particular you'd like me to be praying for? Anything in particular? What that does is, first of all, make sure you have time. Because very often, if you say, if you're actually saying, can I pray for you before we leave? That means you got to go. But if you actually say, how can I pray for you? In what way? Then very often you'll have a 5, 10, 15 minute conversation where the person pours something out that's really bothering him or her. That is great, that for just to have you listen in a non-judgmental way and say, of course you feel that way. Absolutely, you would feel that way. And so if you're able to simply just non-judgmentally be there and then pray to God, which takes a little bit of, you know, that's the reason I read the Psalms. You know, what you have in the Psalms is every single possible situation processed in prayer, every single human possible situation. So the more you read the Psalms, the more you'll know how to pray. But basically, that's what I would do, is I would say, can I pray? And you know what? It doesn't really matter what the person's faith or beliefs are. I've never seen that be turned down. That's one possibility. That's just one idea.
Thank you. I mean, we've got lots of very practical, personal kind of questions here, pastoral questions, really. And we should say, as often say on my other podcast with N.T. Wright, when these pastoral questions come in, do seek wise counsel from someone not on a screen from a real life pastor. Yeah. But Amanda in San Diego firstly says, Pastor Tim, I'm a new Christian, truly enjoy your sermons, listen to them frequently. I am fighting stage 4 colon cancer as a single mum with 2 kids. It is quite a roller coaster as I basically live from scan to scan and treatment to treatment. Yeah. Truly appreciate your prayers and guidance as I navigate this new way of living with cancer. Amanda doesn't have a question, but actually I just wanted to acknowledge that and say thank you, Amanda. But there is a question from someone else who's kind of on the other side of this. Someone who says, I've been caring for my mum who has terminal cancer and has had for several years, and I'm struggling to keep going. Mm-hmm. Caring for her, also serving in ministry. The Lord has been so good and gracious, but it's hard to be still in his presence given all the demands pulling on me. Do you have any guidance on balancing care for others with maintaining our first love relationship in Christ in this season of my life? This experience has exposed the depths of my own sin and selfishness, so I'm often overwhelmed by shame and my own inadequacy. Sorry, Tim, carry on.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. That was very important to hear, and I almost interrupted. On the one hand, I would say, I should bring my wife in here because you're asking you know, a question of her. On the other hand, interestingly enough, 20 years ago, my wife has Crohn's disease, but she had it in a way that was very debilitating 20 years ago, and where I was the caregiver. In fact, it's one of the strange things is we always thought that I was going to outlive my wife. And actually, we've had to spend a lot of time readjusting our idea that it's very possible that she'd outlive me. And that actually has been very difficult for us both, because we've just gotten into the groove of that. But as a caregiver, I do remember, and she would tell me this, she would say, it doesn't help me if you get yourself to the place where you are just utterly burned out. It just does not help me in the long run. And therefore, she said, please don't make unnecessary sacrifices. In fact, that's her term. I'll just lay this on you. An unnecessary sacrifice is one that makes you feel good in the short run. I did that. And yet it actually, it's you're eating into your principle. Now, you know, the difference between, in other words, it's like in an endowment, you don't want to give so much away every year that you eat into the principle. So eventually you're out. Yeah. The endowment has to produce, it produces because it's invested and it produces, and then you give away what the profit is from the investment, but you don't get into the principle. Mm-hmm. And she would say unnecessary sacrifices make you feel virtuous. And partly, frankly, when you're a caretaker, you feel a little guilty that you're better than the other person. Mm-hmm. I do remember that. Mm-hmm. But I felt kind of guilty that I wasn't in pain. I wasn't hurting. I could just get up and go. And it was almost a way to over-sacrifice and over almost burn myself out was almost a way of my saying, I'm with you in all this. And that she would come back and say, this isn't going to help me if you utterly burn out and you get to the place where you don't have any energy. And so at certain points, just create a boundary so that you don't eat into your principles, so that you can be with me for as long as you need to be. I hope that helps. That's what I remember from being a caregiver, even though I'm not one right now.
That's really helpful. That's really helpful principles.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. And there's a great question here from Raj, which I think echoes probably my questions and lots of people's questions about, you know, how could you possibly believe that God exists in the middle of everything you're going through? And, you know, when you don't see him necessarily at work in your life. And so what Raj says is, Pastor Tim, could you please relate a time in your life when you did see God's power manifest so clearly that no other explanation is plausible?
No. Now I'll tell you why. I would say that I actually do not doubt the existence of God, because the evidences I've seen are cumulatively overwhelming. But I think what the questioner is asking is, did you have a particular instance, you know, some event that all by itself was enough to say, now I know there has to be a God? No. And I'm not sure I would know. Now, partly because I'm a, this is one of the reasons why I think British people like me a little more than a lot of Americans, is I'm a skeptical person. I tend to be skeptical. I'm just not, and therefore, because I tend to be skeptical, I can't imagine one thing that would happen that would make me say, well, there can't be any doubt, because you can always doubt. But cumulatively over the years, both intellectually and personally and socially, I've seen people change. I've experienced people that I don't believe are capable of the great things that they are capable of without God. I've thought these things out. I mean, Justin is, in some ways, Justin's, your whole program there is all about why Christianity actually does make sense and the alternatives make less sense. That's one of the reasons I'm a Christian, is that the alternatives, I don't have all the answers, but the alternatives have even fewer.
Yeah.
And if you put the intellectual and the social and the experiential, and right now the reality of God that I'm experiencing in my prayer life, all together, I'm just over the top in certainty. But I can't give you one. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure there is one, but that's because maybe I'm a Tim Keller skeptic.
No, that's really helpful. And I've very often felt the same. If someone asked me to name one specific thing that made me certain God existed, you can always give some, you know, it could always be the cheese I ate for dinner last night or whatever it is. But when you bring all of them together, it's much harder to refute that, because you're having to refute all kinds of lines of evidence and experience and so on. Just sticking with the sort of the whole question of how we share our faith in these kinds of circumstances that we've been talking about, cancer and so on. Here's a question from Luke, who says, any suggestions, please, for how to comfort non-Christian relatives with cancer, especially if they understandably don't want to really think about cancer or suffering generally, and especially not God? How do you, I don't know, have a pastorally sensitive kind of conversation with someone who's in that kind of position, Tim?
Well, some of them, that's a great question. I will never forget there's a page, I think, in a book by Joe Bailey, B-A-Y-L-Y. He was an old InterVarsity fellowship staff worker here in the United States long ago, like in, I think, the 50s, and or maybe 50s, 60s, something like that. And he wrote a book called A View from the Hearse, because three of his children, I think they're all sons, three of his seven children died. He outlived them. And he was writing a book on grief, The View from the Hearse, okay? Mm. And he tells at one, I think a funeral or a wake or something like that, he said a friend came and sat down next to him and said, you know, I know the Lord's working in this, and I'm praying for you, and I know that, you know, all things work together for good, and we just don't understand his ways, and we really have to trust in him, and he's compassionate, and, you know, it's so hard, but, you know, we can really trust him. And Joe, the author, said, I couldn't wait for him to leave. And then he said, another friend came by and sat down next to me and never said anything until I said something, and was always supportive, always economical with his words, basically followed my leads, just showed a tremendous amount of support. And I hated to see him go.
Mm.
And I've never forgotten that page. And I do think that when it comes to someone that doesn't share your faith, I think the most important thing is for you to just show up, for them to see that you really are. They may know that you don't have the same belief system, and for you to show up and really be supportive and not, frankly, push any kind of faith down their throat unless they ask questions.
Mm.
Or if they say, hey, put in a prayer for me or something like that with the guy upstairs. Not that I believe in him, but I wouldn't mind. That sort of thing. Then you have an open door. But don't open the door yourself. You need to let that person open the door to talking about faith. Otherwise, just be just be incredibly loving and supportive, period.
Yeah. Great advice.
Again, just so many brilliant questions coming in. And this is another really practical question. And lots of people have sort of said that it's, you know, they've said that they also want an answer. So it feels like it would be a good one to ask you. This is from Paul Cowley. And he says, hi, Tim, have you ever struggled with anxiety during your treatment? And how did you cope with that practically?
Yes, it's very strange, though. There have been, yes, I mean, before the joke about that term, I mentioned scansiety, which I can tell other people have already, other people who've had cancer know exactly what I'm talking about. There's always some anxiety. For some reason, there are times in which the anxiety is worse than others. And I've never really been able to judge why, frankly. Sometimes it's just a lot worse. And I think you have to remember you're both a body and a soul. And sometimes I actually feel like if I'm not keeping up my exercise, for example, I mean, it can be as simple as that. If I'm not eating the way I should, and I mean, I really need to stay on a regimen to stay, to not gain weight, to not lose weight, to keep my exercise and my stamina up. I find the anxiety gets worse if I'm not exercising. And sometimes exercising is just hard because I don't have the energy I used to have, but I have to push myself. So to some degree, the anxiety seems to get worse when I'm just not doing all the other things. But ultimately, what I have to do is I've got to go to the Psalms. I don't listen, you know, you British people do not get, you know, a big head. But I take the Book of Common Prayers 30 days through the Psalms. You know, it's been broken down. I don't know, Cranmer, I guess, did it, but it's broken down. And you get through it morning and evening. And I'll just say this now. I've actually, Justin, you may know, or Ruth may know, I've been doing it on Twitter a little bit lately, is there is nothing like the Psalms to teach you. And if you're getting through it this fast, that if I'm anxious, you're going to have some Psalms about anxiety. There's Psalms where somebody is tearing you down and you've got enemies. There's Psalms about anxiety. There's Psalms about depression, Psalms about guilt. And if they're coming through, you know, 150 every 30 days, there's going to be Psalms about anxiety just grab you. And so the way I deal with the anxiety is I keep my Psalms up and I keep my exercise up. And that's the best I can do.
Just to plug as well, you've written so many books, Tim. You might have even forgotten you wrote this one, but I really found helpful your devotional book, My Rock, My Refuge, which goes through the Psalms for the course of a year. Just and when you have to face all of them, even the kind of, you know, quite harsh imprecatory Psalms, it's actually really helpful to kind of just say, okay, yeah, there's a lot of human emotion in these Psalms, and it's okay.
Those psalms are sometimes you say, my goodness, why in the world would God have allowed that to be there? You know, Derek Kidner, you know, the great British Old Testament scholar, he says the fact that God allows these cries in the scriptures shows he understands. And then he says he knows how we speak when we're desperate. So there's that one place, Psalm 137, where it says, blessed is he who does to you what you did to us and dashes the heads of your little ones like on the rocks. And you say, what's that doing in the Bible? Well, Derek Kidner says, isn't that amazing? God understands that sometimes that's how we feel. And that was so comforting to me. And so I do think I usually tell people going through anxiety, discouragement, that sort of thing, immerse yourself in the Psalms because you'll find ways to process that particular emotion before God.
Yeah.
I've got a question here from Verstige, who has a question about prayer and what do we pray and what about unanswered prayer? So he simply asks, Pastor Tim, praying for recovery or healing is obviously not always answered. That would make some doubt God. So should I always pray for recovery, or is accepting that life as it comes is also a possible Christian response, that I'm simply sort of trusting God? Where do you fall on this question of how we pray, what we should pray when we're facing these kinds of situations?
Yes. I love the fact that the book of Job allows, at the end of the book of Job, if you have a very pietistic approach that says, well, You never complain to God. You never say, God, why are you doing this? Or why are you letting this happen? You get to the end of the book of Job, and God is vindicating Job and saying to his friends, you know, Job has pleased me, but you don't please me. And maybe if Job prays for you, I won't smite you. And we pietistic types, we read the book of Job and say, I'm surprised that God is not more critical of Job at the very end, because it doesn't seem like Job was very respectful at various places. But I had an Old Testament professor at Gordon Conwell Seminary years ago, Dr. Meredith Klein, who says, the thing is, it's true that Job did very often, you know, shake his fist and complain and grump and cry out and fall down and chew on the rug, but he did it in front of God. Mm-hmm. He didn't walk away. He never walked away from God, because he was always talking to God about it.
Yeah.
And therefore, God actually showed that Job beat Satan, because Satan said, does Job serve God for nothing? See, in other words, Job is really in it. He doesn't love you for yourself alone, the devil said to God in the beginning of Job. He loves you for what he's getting. So if you take away the profit margin, if it goes away, so it looks like what I'm giving to God is actually, exceeded by what I'm getting from God, then he's going to go away. Mm-hmm. And guess what? By the end, he never did that, which means God can make human beings into people who actually love him for himself alone. Now, you would never think that the way he was talking to God, that he was being all that loving. But as long as you don't walk away from God, as long as you're complaining and being upset, but you're still talking to him, that shows that you love him for himself alone, and not just for the good things he's giving you. Mm-hmm. So just don't stop praying. And that's actually a way of saying to God, I love you for who you are, not just for what you do for me. But on the other hand, be realistic. You don't have to, you take a look at what Job says. You don't really have to tamp down those feelings.
Mm. I mean, what about that prayer that's specifically mentioned about prayer for healing? I mean, have you kind of had people praying for healing for you too?
Yes.
And how do you kind of, how do you square that theologically with the fact that obviously healing doesn't always happen?
Well, I pray, by the way, I would say at least twice a day I pray for healing, complete healing, even though my doctor told me there is no cure for pancreatic stage 4. Once it's out there, you'll die of it. I've been praying for healing. God can do it, or he doesn't have to do it. I mean, this is years and years of experience with him. When I look back on things that he did for me that at the time I thought were awful, but now I realize were actually good for me. It's just years of experience. I say, look, he knows. Mm-hmm. I mean, that may sound a little too easy for those of you who are saying, no, I can't die yet. I mean, I'm not young with children still at home, and I think that is really, really tough. On the other hand, when I got this cancer diagnosis, I was 69 years old. I remember Kathy and I looked at each other and said, we thought we'd feel a lot older when we got to 69. We always thought we'd feel like, hey, you know, my life's over. No. So it's not like we haven't struggled, but I think in the just years of experiences, the Lord, he knoweth. And I can't possibly be sure. He knows. So, I mean, ultimately, I'm praying for healing, and just the fact that I may not get that is something that I say, okay, God knows.
Mm. Tim, we've had quite a lot of questions about your prayer life. You mentioned earlier that you pray, satisfy me every morning with your steadfast love, which is brilliant. There's a question here from Lisa Harmon, which says, what specifically did you do to change your prayer life? I think that's kind of in relation to the fact that you were saying in some ways you wished that you and Kathy prayed how you do now, post-diagnosis. But right. Is there something specific, I guess, that changed? And if so, what was that?
Well, I would say that this came in two stages. When I was in my 50s, the first time I had cancer, and it was thyroid cancer. I had my thyroid out. And there was a period there where, he maketh me to lie down. And he did. And during that time, I actually did have something of a renaissance in how I prayed. That's where I got into the Psalms at a much deeper level, where I worked through the Psalms and where I started praying them more often. I also started to do a better job of learning how to meditate. And I'd read that article. Well, it was a letter. You know, Martin Luther wrote a letter to his barber, who asked him, "Master Luther, how should I pray?" And he wrote a 40-page letter to him about prayer. But basically, in that letter, which you can find online, and you kind of have to get through the first part of it. It's kind of he's chatty, but eventually he gets to a place where he talks about a way of meditating, so that it warms your heart up. And what he does is he would say, choose the idea, then do adoration, confession, supplication. It's very interesting, where you don't go from Bible study to prayer. You go from Bible study into meditation to prayer. Now, the difference between meditation and prayer is very simple. Take a look at Psalm 103. Okay. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits. Now, who's he talking to? That's not a prayer. He's talking to himself. Mm-hmm. And what he's actually doing is he's saying, do you really understand what this means? Do you see the benefits? You're meditating on them and thinking about them. John Owen would say, you're not just saying, oh, I know that Jesus Christ became a human being. He says, do you see the glory of it? Which I think John Owen means, think about the beauty of that. So you're meditating. You're not just, I read this thing in the Bible. Now I'm meditating on it till your heart is warm, until it begins to affect you. And there's a lot I've written in my book on prayer on that and others. And then you move to prayer. Now that all happened 20 years ago, where I added meditation and I added the Psalms. And I also added morning and evening rather than only praying in the morning. Those were the three things. But then when I got my cancer, it was a matter of more, you might say, turbocharging. I spent more time doing those things. Mm. So that was the and God obviously was getting me ready with the thyroid cancer for the pancreatic cancer. So I wouldn't say the change now was so much it was Ms. Method as much as just giving it the time and being way, 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 way more regular.
Yeah.
Whereas the basic methods that I learned about 20 years ago, now I was using in a way that I never really got a chance to use them. So that's kind of a long answer, but yeah. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's helpful. Thank you.
There's a couple of questions on forgiveness specifically, which obviously we referenced earlier on in the show and the new book to that effect. Some kind of personal ones, some theological ones here. Hannah, for instance, says, how do I forgive when I know I need to, because God has forgiven me of all my sin and calls me to forgive, but I actually just want to walk away from the person and stay angry with them? So this is a really practical kind of real life question. What do you do when you just don't want to forgive someone?
Well, on the one hand, I do want to say, and this is a little... on the side of the person, on the side of the part of you that really doesn't like the person, I want to say that forgiveness does not mean automatically learning to trust them. In other words, when I forgive somebody, it doesn't mean I have to trust them immediately. They have to re-earn my trust. And if they don't re-earn my trust, if they don't change, then I really don't know that you have to be, I don't think you have to be as intimate. You can forgive without being as intimate as you were before. I think some people say, well, if I forgive, that means I have to go back and do everything. Mm-hmm. Well, it's never loving to make it easy for somebody to sin against you. Mm. Think about that. It's not loving to the person. And so if you've got a person who just is very intemperate in what they say, I'll give you an example in 1 second. That doesn't mean you necessarily have to allow them to be intemperate in the way they talk to you. So you don't really have to, in order to forgive, you don't really have to necessarily trust them. If they don't change, if they don't make those kinds of changes, I don't think you have to do that. However, Forgiveness means saying, I'm not going to revenge myself on the person. And secondly, I'm not going to keep replaying the recordings of what that person did to me. Because that's part of what makes you feel kind of noble. And it almost feels like it's a bit of payback. It's internal payback. And it's that's what forgiveness is, to say that vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Lord, you know what this person deserves. I don't. I don't have the right to try to inflict judgment on them because I'm a sinner. Number two, I don't really know what they deserve because I don't know everything they've gone through. So I don't have the right. I don't have the knowledge, and I actually don't have the power to give them what they deserve. So I'm not going to pay them back. I'm not going to pay them back directly trying to hurt them, but I'm also not going to try to pay them back by thinking about how awful they are inside. You need to turn your heart away from replaying. I just show you how old I am. I used to say, don't keep replaying those tapes. Younger people don't know what tapes are. I said, don't keep replaying the tapes. Don't keep replaying that, because that keeps you angry and it keeps you locked in. Mm. Yeah. So I would say no payback. That's what forgiveness is. I refuse to pay back. I'm not going to try to hurt the person, and I'm not going to replay that over and over and over again. Yeah. And I'm going to let God give the person what they deserve. Meanwhile, my relationship with them, I need to do as much as I possibly can to, no, not ignore them, not stay away from them, not be discourteous to them. But if they don't make any changes.
And I'm
sorry, you know what? I can tell you one example. There was a woman who had an abusive father, I mean, an adult woman with a father who tended to abuse her verbally. Mm-hmm. And she said, I'm going to call you every Tuesday night, Dad, because you're my dad. But I want you to know that if you start to abuse me, I'm not going to say, Dad, stop it, or I'm not going to get angry at you. I'm going to hang up. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to call you back next week because I'm not mad at you. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to help you. And also, it's not right for you to do that. Yeah. And eventually, it's really interesting. 3 or 4 weeks in a row, he did a normal thing. And she just said, Dad, hanging up, and then called back. And eventually it changed him. She was on the holding him accountable and still forgiving him.
You're listening to Unbelievable, the live show that Ruth Jackson and I recently hosted with Tim Keller. More of the questions coming in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to a show in which we're putting out the live program we did with Tim Keller just before Christmas. Hope you enjoy the rest of the questions that we asked Tim and his answers. They're coming up in just a moment's time. We'll have some of your feedback towards the end of today's show, and we'll also hear some of the suggestions for guests and topics that you gave me for the new year. Every New Year's Day on my social media, I ask for your suggestions, and they came in by the bucket load. So we'll hear what you want to hear on the program towards the end of today's show, as well as some of your feedback to recent programs. Coming up tonight on The Profile, Ram Gidamal, successful entrepreneur and businessman here in the UK, who has long supported ministry among Christians from Southeast Asia. He'll be talking about his life and faith. That's The Profile this evening at 8 p.m. and, of course, via its own podcast. You're just looking for The Profile. Next week here on Unbelievable, Paranormal Hauntings and Exorcism. A Christian and skeptic join me for a discussion. Matt Arnold is editor of the Christian Parapsychologist Journal. Dr. Cal Cooper is a psychologist and paranormal researcher. They'll be speaking to me about how they interpret accounts of ghosts, exorcism, and apparitions as a Christian and a skeptic. That is going to be an interesting show. And funnily enough, the podcast and video releases on Friday, the 13th of January. So seems like quite an appropriate day for the topic, doesn't it? So look out for that next week. And don't forget, you can get more from the show at our website. As ever, it's premierunbelievable.com. Let's get back to the final questions that you posed for Tim Keller. I was going to just follow up with another question that sort of comes, I suppose, on the heels of that. And I was going to say as well, to that person who's asking, how do I forgive when I don't want to forgive? Well, kind of in the same way that you said, you know, just being there before God and not walking away, even though you're angry and whatever, God sees that you're struggling and that you know you don't want to struggle.
Yeah.
And that is, even just the wanting not to feel like this is a start for grace to potentially come through.
Absolutely, Justin.
Yeah. Totally. Terry will also wants, so this has a more kind of specifically theological question here, who says, my understanding of the Christian God is that he requires sinners to repent and ask for forgiveness before he will forgive. If that's true, then why should we be expected to forgive regardless of whether or not the offender is repentant, says Terry. I'm not sure if Terry is a Christian himself, yeah. but he's got this question.
That's a great question. Now, if I was just going to beat you over the head with a Bible verse, it would be Mark chapter 11, verse 25. Now, of course, I'm going to be really nice about it. See, but Mark chapter 11, verse 25 says, if you stand, this is Jesus talking. If you stand praying and realize you have anything against anyone, forgive them. So it's a pretty blanket statement. Yet the questioner is right, because then in Luke 17, it says, if a person repents 70 times, you have to forgive them. Well, it seems like a contradiction, except it's not. Hmm. If you want a reconciled relationship, the other person has to repent. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, you really can have a reconciled relationship till that person repents. And I actually was alluding to that a minute ago when I said, if that person doesn't make any changes, you don't have to trust them and get back into that relationship. But on the other hand, I think you need to do an internal forgiveness where you say, I'm not going to do payback. Then you can go to them and call them to repent. And I can tell you something very interesting. If you don't forgive before you go to them, then you will probably go in order not just to help them, but to basically hurt them. And they can tell that the reason you're confronting them is to make them feel as bad as you feel like he made you feel or she made you feel. Mm-hmm. And therefore, generally speaking, if you don't forgive before you go to try to get that reconciled relationship, you do a lousy job of it. The other person just sees that you're just trying to hurt them, and then they get their back up and you never get them to change at all. So, but the main difference is that the reason you need to forgive, even though the other person has repented, at least internally, is because you're a sinner and they're a sinner. Whereas when God forgives, God is holy. God is perfect. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the best way to answer that, I think.
Brilliant. Thank you, Tim. Just as we're sort of wrapping this up, this feels like a really great question. It's from Matthew, and he says, what do you know after decades of ministry that you wish you knew fresh out of seminary? And his context is that he's about to wrap up his own MDiv and look for a pastorate in his area. And if it's not too presumptuous, I'd love to just add my own question to that, which is, you know, what do you wish you knew at the beginning of your cancer diagnosis that you've sort of learned in the past few years that you kind of wish you could go back and say to yourself?
Well, the first question is a lot easier than you might think. It's and actually the two answers I'm about to give you are pretty similar, though. There is no doubt that everybody told me at seminary, you got to have a prayer life. I just, you know, look, going back, I just wish I had seen how important it was. Mm-hmm. I just didn't. There is no doubt about it that the prayer life, which is the prayer time, was often squeezed out by things I had to get done because people asked me to do this and I never finished it last night. So I get up early in the morning. I got to do it before I get into work. And where does it come from? It comes from your prayer time. Mm-hmm. And that's just wrong. And it's very clear that, in other words, what people think of me is more important than what God thinks of me. That their high regard, oh my goodness, you're getting so much done, is more important than God's regard. When I look back on it, just that very fact that I was constantly letting what people thought about me, overcome and veto my time with God. Mm. That was the main thing. I knew that would sort of happen, but boy, I didn't realize it just took a terrible toll on me. I could have been a far better minister if I just said, No, I can't. I'm sorry if somebody's going to say, you promised that it'd be done by the end of the month. And instead I got up and I prayed because that was at the time. And I just very seldom did that. Yeah. I just really needed to make sure people were okay. And it's similar, I'd say, my answer is that what I said before, and that is, I wish I'd been able, without getting cancer, to just know how mortal I am. Mm. And you know, what Psalm 90 says, teach us to number our days that we get a heart for wisdom. What does that mean? I know what it means now. But I don't know how you do that before you really have something like this. I just don't know. There's just a breakthrough in the way in which I look at everything. Once I realized, my goodness, I've been in denial. So I guess, I hate to do that, Ruth, to you, but I mean, I basically would answer your question with reference to what I said before. I'm not sure there is a way. It's actually, Kathy's mother had five children. We only had three. But Kathy's mother used to say to her, I want to write a book someday, how to raise the first child like the fifth, which meant not so worried, you know, not so upset, you know, really relaxed. And Kathy said, that's impossible, Mom. I don't care. There's no way you can possibly raise the first child like the fifth. Never, ever, ever. Because you just have to go through it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to go through having that first child and being worried about it. Ooh, why is she doing that? Why is she just upset? Should I take her to the doctor? And by the time you get to the third, fourth, fifth child, you realize they're resilient. The same thing. There's no way to get to where I was, where I am now, I think, without going through the doctor saying, you're going to die from this. Mm-hmm. I wish there had been, but there isn't. But I'm glad I'm where I am.
Yeah, well, thank you for being with us tonight, Tim. It's a great place to end it, actually, with that call to put prayer first as we enter a new year. It's often the thing that people try, sometimes fail to do, obviously, but it's been certainly an inspiration for me as well to hear you say that. And so thank you very much. And thank you for answering so many of those questions. They were all fired at you completely blind. But I'm sorry we weren't able to get to more of the questions that came in. But our next webinar is on Tuesday, the 10th of January, the new year, How to Live Faithfully in a Technologically Confusing World. It's with British bioethics expert John Wyatt, who, of course, hosts our own Matters of Life and Death podcast. But you can actually register for it right now if you want to get your place at unbelievable.live. So that's available to register for right away. And I just want to remind you before we leave you that we do have that excellent John Lennox course on Science, Faith and the Evidence for God. And finally, if you are able to support us, that will mean a great deal as we come towards the end of our year. And if you're able to stand with us financially and help us continue to produce resources for thinking faith, reaching out to skeptics, seekers and Christians, then please do that if you can. And we will send you that ebook. It's called In Conversation with Tim Keller, just like we have been tonight, but you'll be able to read the conversation for yourself. So I just want to say again, thank you so much, Tim, for being with us. It's wonderful of you to give up some of your time, and I wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Thank you both to you. Right back at you, as we say here.
Really, really enjoyed getting to host that along with Ruth. And just a heads up that it's not too late to get that ebook that I mentioned as well, In Conversation with Tim Keller. As a thank you for a gift, we've got the donation link still open for podcast listeners. Just go to premierunbelievable.com/Keller or look for the link with today's show. You can give and still receive that ebook, In Conversation with Tim Keller. Thanks, by the way, to Tim, who tweeted after attending the live show, this was a must-listen episode. As someone who's walking through a cancer journey with my wife, it brought much hope and fresh perspective. Had a lot of similar feedback as well to that from others. Thanks, Tim, for getting in touch. And as you heard mentioned, our next live show is also open for booking. Artificial intelligence, advanced robotics, DNA technology. How do we live faithfully in a technologically confusing world? Dr. John Wyatt, host of our Matters of Life and Death podcast and author of The Robot Will See You Now, joins me to take your questions on our first live show of the new year, Tuesday, the 10th of January. Free to attend as usual online. Just register at unbelievable.live. Again, the link is with today's show. And if you'd like to feedback on anything you heard on today's program, or just send me an email about anything you like, really, you can do that, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I read all the emails. I can't respond to all of them, can't read them all out, but we do try and get to a good number of them on the show. We'll go to some of them in just a moment's time. Just want to also mention before we do that the London Unbelievable Discussion Group, their next meeting is on Monday the 9th of January. Ancient Biography and the Gospels with John Nelson will be under discussion. They meet regularly at the Cock Tavern, just between King's Cross and Euston Station in London. That's going to be at 7 p.m. on Monday the 9th of January. It's very much something attended by both Christians and sceptics. It's organised by a sort of combination of Christians and sceptics. It is not officially part of Unbelievable, but I do announce when they've got their group coming up. Well, let's go to some of your feedback. And first of all, over on Twitter, thanks to those who responded to a video I put out on my own social media over the holidays, advertising the audio version of my audiobook, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. Leonard got in touch to say he loved the book and donated his copy to his school's library after finishing it so it could be used in our discussions. Glad to see the book is still making the rounds, people picking it up. Every week I hear of people who are still using and buying and getting hold of that book. It's probably 5 or 6 years now since it was released, but glad to see it's still going strong. In fact, there's a new book on the way. September 2023 is when we'll be launching a book I've just submitted for publication. It's called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, and very much tells the story of the implosion of new atheism and how it's been replaced by a new conversation on God by interesting secular thinkers like Tom Holland, Douglas Murray, Jordan Peterson, and others. So look out for more about that later on in this new year. Ron also got in touch to say, I'm almost 80 as a clinical staff chaplain since 1979. I appreciate your non-aggressive approach and clarification on the Unbelievable show. Your adherence to the authority of Scripture is also impressive. All the best, Chaplain Ron. Glad you've been enjoying the show, Ron. And Rick in New York has been enjoying our new John Lennox course, which we released at the beginning of December. I've just completed the Science and Faith course with Dr. Lennox and Dave Rubin, found it extremely useful in my own apologetics ministry. I've listened to Dave Rubin quite a lot, and I appreciate the candid views he projects without vitriol or anger. I believe I could have a meaningful conversation with him regarding faith that wouldn't delve into ad hominem attacks. And Dr. Lennox has been a hero of mine for some time. I've read several of his books and learned a great deal. I credit Unbelievable with introducing me to him. I listen to your podcasts, find them intriguing and engaging. I always appreciate the spectrum of speakers you have on the show. It's the contrast between believer and secular viewpoints that's been most informational for me. Over the last several years, I've been trying to learn not to become so dogmatic in my approach to apologetics. I learned so much from these conversations, and Unbelievable has been instrumental in my development. I've now downloaded your Confident Christianity course and look forward to completing it very soon. Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation for a cup of coffee if I ever find myself in New York, and a real slice of New York pizza, Rick. Great to know you benefited from that Science and Faith course with John Lennox. And if you want to get hold of that, as you probably heard mentioned already, it's available as ever from our website, premierunbelievable.com/Lennox. Here's Andreas in Munich in Germany, who gets in touch, having also bumped into our John Lennox Science and Faith course, and says he really enjoys John Lennox's stuff, and says, but his first contact with the Unbelievable show was on YouTube when I accidentally ran into the discussion between Peter Singer and Andy Bannister that you hosted. I was impressed by the respectful attitude that you and Mr. Bannister treated your atheist guest with. Mutual respect is something I also recognise between John Lennox and Richard Dawkins during their debate at the Museum of Natural History in Oxford. Quite different to the often spiteful tone I've had to deal with listening to the audio version of The God Delusion. I think a personal encounter between opponents makes all participants aware of the fact that the opponent is still a human being that deserves respect. Mr. Dawkins sees for sure the benefits from participating in such discussions, i.e. being able to advertise for his conviction, and thus maintains a polite way when discussing. But my hope is that atheist contemporaries also recognise that there is another spirit behind the respect they receive in these discussions. If I understood correctly what Mr. Lennox mentioned, Richard Dawkins was quite touched by the contribution Francis Collins made in supporting Christopher Hitchens during his last months of life. You're doing an important work from my perspective. I searched in vain for formats like Unbelievable in Germany, recognizing that in the Anglo-American world, open and substantial discussions between believers and non-believers have obviously become kind of a standard, and I find them very encouraging. Thanks, Andreas. Hope you had a good Christmas and New Year. Lovely to hear from you. Here's Peter, who says, thank you for your epic podcasts. I go back to the early days with you, and I never miss a new episode or a revived oldie. I've listened to every episode some multiple times. Just want to thank you for your work and strengthening my faith through debate. I want to share a story with you. Last week, I was involved in a car hijack.
I was pushed into the back seat as the car was driven off at speed. There was a guy in the back with me and two men in the front of the car. The driver sounded a lot like you sound, and the other guy in the front even called him Justin. He also had a look of your own good self. They were all talking between themselves about spiritual issues, and I found myself trying to join in with them. Justin was completely ignoring me and just talking over me. I was shouting and screaming at them all. If you want the answer, go back to the Bible and you'll find it there, I said. I was getting more and more angry. Why won't you talk with me? I can help you with your issues. But now I was completely cut out of the conversation. This Justin guy, who was driving very fast, interrupted me every time I spoke. By now I was in a rage, screaming at them all as they just talked over me. The next thing I remember, I was under my quilt, trying to understand what was happening to me. My ears were sore. It was 4 a.m. Life lesson: if you have iPods listening to Unbelievable, and set the sleep timer, or risk being in a debate when no one listens to you. It's hell, and I don't even believe in hell. Can we have more debates on the Trinity? Something I struggle with. I feel it's more post-biblical tradition with interpretation added to the original text, and you suggest a guest for that. Well, thank you. I was just highly amused as I was wondering where it was going as I was reading your email there, Peter. But yes, it made sense when you said it was a dream inspired by having Unbelievable set in your sleep timer. Thanks for getting in touch. Thanks for the show suggestion as well. We may well come back to the Trinity at some point this year. And thanks to all others who have been getting in touch, including the many people coming up with show suggestions for this coming year. Now, I've had a lot of those on my social media, and I will be looking through them all, categorizing them, trying to see what we can make happen in the course of the coming year. But a number of you have also been getting in touch by email after I said you could email in with your suggestions. Sam Otto says, you've had a few discussions recently on homosexuality and transgenderism, which are modern topics that need to be spoken of in light of scripture. I applaud you for addressing them. However, those topics affect a fairly small minority of the population. One issue around sexuality that affects the vast majority, and I believe deserves a debate, is pornography. Rates vary, but it's estimated that around 90% of adult men and 70% of adult women engage in internet pornography. I've noticed a growing trend towards the normalisation, acceptance and promotion of pornography. I know it's a graphic topic, but I think it's well worth a debate. There are many questions around it. This is an issue that's extremely relevant in so many people's lives. One person I know who's very informed on the topic is Dr. Ted Roberts of Pure Desire Ministries, who for years has been counselling men and providing a curriculum to help people leave behind sexual addiction. A person to bear him with may be Dr. Marika Rose of the University of Winchester, who I know takes a different stance on Christian theology and pornography. Of course, you can find other people to debate. These are just suggestions, but I think this is an extremely relevant issue that would be worth addressing. Thanks for the suggestion, Sam. Do appreciate it. Vicky says, have you had Nancy Piercy on your show? We've just read her book, Love Thy Body, as a church group to discuss and understand more fully some of the tricky issues of our day. She'd be great in a debate. I think all Christians and leaders should read that book. Thank you. It's another great suggestion, Nancy Piercy. Yes, I've certainly heard her in an interview about that book. I haven't actually read the book myself, but I'd like to soon. So thanks for the suggestion, Vicky. And Elizabeth Pike in the US says, I'm an avid listener and appreciate all your podcasts. I'd be so grateful if you could explore further the topic of the James Webb Telescope. I listened to the July podcast when you re-aired a Matters of Life and Death podcast on it, but found myself wanting to hear much more. To me, the James Webb Telescope is pointing us to God directly. That the universe we see in those pictures shows me that our arguments over doctrinal differences, or our extreme efforts to interpret a line of scripture to fit our existing assumptions, or even our rigid boundaries among religions and faith traditions, are so incredibly small as to be almost immaterial. The God, the creator, that we see in those pictures is so freeing to me, because it allows me to realise that I can put down the worries and the strivings about finding the quote-unquote right answer and just rest in the knowledge that God is so, so, so much bigger than our human imaginings. Thank you for considering it. Thank you, Elizabeth. Well, it's an interesting idea. I mean, in a way, you're taking it outside of just talking about the James Webb Telescope, talking about how we should conceive of God in light of, I suppose, the universe and our smallness and how much we can reasonably conceive about God through doctrine and so on. But all interesting suggestions. Thank you. So, yeah, if you want to add yours to those suggestions, please feel free to do so.
unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And in future episodes, I'll dig through some of the suggestions, the many suggestions that came in on our social media. You can follow the show on Twitter at unbelievablefe. You can go to our Facebook page to facebook.com/premierunbelievable. One last piece of feedback, and this is to the show on buffer zones, praying outside abortion clinics that we discussed between Louise McClatchy and Anne Furedi just before Christmas. I hadn't realised that actually there was going to be a viral video doing the rounds shortly after that show released, showing someone actually being arrested for precisely this and praying silently outside an abortion clinic. So it's been in the news and social media headlines recently, interestingly, since we brought that show out. But here's someone who wanted to get in touch with their own personal experience of this. Helen says, thanks for the interesting shows. I'm a volunteer pavement counsellor. Earlier in the year, two or three of us quietly prayed on just a few occasions for about an hour outside my local BPAS clinic. We offer alternative services such as free counselling, healthcare, accommodation and monetary support not offered by the clinic. I'm used to the BPAS manager calling the police simply because we're there. The police arrive and let us know we're not breaking the law. We already know, as does the manager. It's all recorded on the CCTV outside the clinic. Back in August, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak competed for leadership, promising to increase safety on the streets for women. A newspaper also ran a fake story about abortion protests outside the abortion clinic with a photoshopped picture and fabricated narrative, quoting the manager, who spoke about women being distressed inside the clinic by noisy protests outside. Well, I inquired of a car mechanic located right next to the clinic, plus also asked the community police officers nearby if they were aware of these protests. All said no. I wrote to the newspaper appealing to their sense of integrity. You can easily find out the truth by checking the CCTV, but no response from them. This is a deliberate misleading of the public by mainstream media and abortion providers. Moreover, there's no requirement in biology GCSE to teach the facts that most embryo development happens in the first 9 weeks, not long after a woman discovers she is pregnant. So young women leave school with the impression that a fetus at 8 weeks is the size of a poppy seed and that sex is at best consensual. The abortionists are under no obligation to explain accurately what happens to a baby during an abortion. Euphemisms such as terminating a pregnancy are used, so the horror is covered up. This cover-up enables them to keep up the pretense of being a legitimate healthcare provider who happens to make money out of women and their so-called unwanted pregnancy. In the words of some young women who shared recently on another YouTube podcast, typically when you go for a medical procedure, you're given information, shown images about what will be done to you, but in an abortion, this information is sidelined. I myself nearly had an abortion. When I became pregnant right after uni, everyone said I should just get an abortion. Many friends had already done it. My discernment was also blunted by having studied biology up to A level, yet still being unaware that a fetus is a living person. It's interesting that Anne Furedi admits women are distressed inside the clinic. I suggest this is because women instinctively know there's something not quite right, but don't know what it is. In my experience, women don't get distressed declining a leaflet or seeing someone praying outside the clinic. Prayer is a universal symbol of hope. Abortion is not like having a tooth out. Despite Anne Furedi's provocative language against pavement counsellors, describing them as immoral, cruel and unrighteous, she never once acknowledged that abortion is the cruelest way to kill a child. In my case, the one person who said, "Let's keep the baby," and explained that abortion was not a good thing, was the father of the child. That was over 30 years ago. He had grown up in a third world country. It turns out that most women keep their baby if the pregnancy is supported by the father. So all the talk about it being a woman's choice is another false narrative. Abortion benefits men who want to have responsibility-free sex. It benefits abortionists who make money out of it. It shocks me how gullible some feminists can be. So that's Helen's perspective on that. You're welcome to give an alternative view if you would like to. Again, you can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Thanks for being with us on this week's edition of the show, and I hope you can come back again next time. Don't forget that you can support the show, and you can also receive that Tim Keller In Conversation With ebook if you do so by going to our link with today's show at premierunbelievable.com/Keller. And don't forget that our next live show is just around the corner. Dr. John Wyatt talking about how to live faithfully in a technologically confusing world. You can register for it right now at unbelievable.live and join us on Tuesday this coming week. For now, let me tell you what's coming up next time on the show. Well, the podcast and video will land on Friday the 13th of January, so it's an appropriate day to be talking about paranormal hauntings and exorcism. I'm joined by Matt Arnold, editor of the Christian Parapsychologist Journal, and Dr. Cal Cooper, a psychologist and paranormal researcher, speaking to me about how they interpret these accounts of ghosts, exorcisms, and apparitions as a Christian and a skeptic. Should be an interesting one. For now, thanks for being with us. See you next time.